Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming possibility of a Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine as tanks, artillery and troops mass on the Russian side of the border. Robert English, a professor of international relations at USC, who has an article in the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea, joins us. We'll discuss how the presence of extreme right-wing elements in the new Ukrainian government are playing into Putin's propaganda, like waving a red flag in front of a nervous bull, and that the US and the EU should denounce these elements and seek compromise with Russia. Then we'll look into the continuing street battles and demonstrations in Venezuela, in which both student protesters and National Guardsmen have been killed. David Smaldi, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has researched Venezuela for the last 20 years and lived there for 10 years, joins us from Caracas to provide an update on this increasingly polarized confrontation between a government supported by the majority who are poor and the country's middle class who are fed up and frustrated by shortages of basic commodities, soaring inflation, and rampant crime. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Mansour El-Kahia, who is a Libyan-American scholar, columnist, activist, and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas, San Antonio. We will discuss the Libyan parliament's dismissal of the country's prime minister for failing to stop a North Korean tanker loaded with oil from a rebel-controlled terminal from escaping to sea, and the growing divisions between the lawless tribal west of the country and the separatist east, now in control of a number of oil terminals, but divided between secular rebels and Islamist militants. And joining us now is Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the U.S. Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security. He is currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity, and he has an article in the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert English.
Thank you.
And of course, speaking of Putin's actions in Crimea, we don't know whether the Russian military is poised on the Ukrainian border, and it could in fact move in to eastern Ukraine. And the referendum, of course, takes place in a couple of days. And as a referendum, then in fact, there's no way you can vote no. you have two choices. One of which is to vote for a Russian annexation, and the other one is to vote for a 1991 compact that does the same thing.
I'm hoping that however the vote goes, and presumably it will be strongly in favor of joining Russia, that will serve mainly to give Putin stronger cards, but not to foreclose a compromise. In other words, that he doesn't have to go ahead and begin a process of outright annexation, but simply has a stronger hand, more leverage in this wrangling with the West and with the new Ukrainian government. And I think most sensible people see a compromise, which would be greater autonomy for Crimea within a sovereign Ukraine, and other protections and guarantees for the rights, cultural, linguistic, and so forth, of the large Russian population in Ukraine.
Well, but what explains this maneuver on the border? It's either ramping up pressure or it's the precursor for the real thing.
What explains it is the same thing that explains our and NATO's essentially similar actions, maneuvers, patrols, flights near the Russian border from some of the Baltic, Poland, those NATO countries. Both sides are kind of saber-rattling. And again, it would be a tragedy of unbelievable proportions if fighting really breaks out. But I'm hoping instead both sides can rattle their sabers and try to strengthen their hands, but then pull back from the brink and find a compromise along the lines of what I just described.
Well, I thought what you wrote in your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea, that you pointed out here, just quoting your article, given our own hypocrisy, don't violate agreements except the ones to expand NATO eastward, don't invade countries on phony pretexts except Iraq, and don't support minority secession movements except Kosovo. So we, of course, our credibility is not great. And most of the mail I get criticizing my reporting on this is basically saying that the Ukrainian government are a bunch of fascists, which is what Putin is saying. But it's a little more nuanced than that, surely. And your argument in your article basically is, why wave a red flag in front of a nervous bull? But that leads you to ask the question, you know, with the new Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, who was just at the White House, who's Jewish, at the head of this government, why let all of these right-wing people in and take important cabinet posts? Is there any way that they can clean up their act and purge these people so that they don't give Putin the excuse that he may use, which is, you know, to invade Ukraine?
Yeah, there's a lot of complexities there. One is that, of course, Putin and the kind of propaganda, it really is propaganda coming out of Moscow and locally in Crimea, is really overheated in portraying a kind of immediate threat to life and limb for the Russian population there. That's not true. That's not real. And unfortunately, because it's so over the top, it's led many in the West, unfortunately, including some of our diplomatic officials, to dismiss any Russian concerns out of hand, when in fact, the point of my article is that there are real concerns, not some kind of paramilitary attacks, killing of Russians tomorrow, but the complexion of the Ukrainian government going forward, which, as you know, as I noted, is so strongly overrepresenting the far right and the extreme Ukrainian nationalists, the Svoboda Party, which is not the only such organization, but the most prominent, the best known, has five key positions in the new government. And essentially it has seven or eight because it has some former members, some founding members, including now in this right sector paramilitary group in the government as well. So if we say that the extreme nationalists have seven or eight key positions, that's 2 to 3 times what their electoral results, right? The last parliamentary elections in 2012 when they got about 10%. They're way overrepresented in this government, so that's sort of a concern right there. And, of course, they've been explicit over almost 2 decades with a strongly xenophobic, anti-Russian, anti-Semitic platform and ideology that's just truly odious. So that they're so powerful in this new government, even if they haven't taken any concrete actions yet, is an enormous concern.
So what explains, the fact that John McCain stood next to the founder of Svoboda, who is an anti-Semite? He's not in the parliament, but he's an unsavory character. And, of course, the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, has also rubbed shoulders with these people. She's a neocon left over. She worked for Dick Cheney. It's astounding to me that after what the neocons wrought in Iraq, that she'd be in Obama's government. Do you have any understanding of that?
As best I can tell, neither Nuland nor McCain meant to explicitly endorse these really repugnant right-wing characters. They were simply caught up in the photo opportunity and the excitement of being there in the mass protests and weren't very careful about whom they associated with, whom they posed for pictures with. They were very sloppy. I don't suspect that either one is anti-Semitic or is directly supporting this kind of new government. But they did it nonetheless. It was from the point of view of diplomatic protocol and what U.S. officials abroad ought to be doing and not be doing. It was a flagrant violation of both their Senate and diplomatic roles. We don't take sides. We don't associate with bad guys, but they did. And so the main effect is this sort of tacit endorsement that the U.S., again, this is how it's seen on the Russian side, which is understandably a little nervous, if not outright paranoid. We ought to have been a lot more careful. And having done that, my argument is that we should make sure we distance ourselves from this kind of ideology, from this kind of political force, and we haven't.
So, Robert English, what explains this imbalance in this new government with an over-representation from these right-wing thugs, anti-Semites, and, you know, neo-Nazis? Here I am, I'm sounding like Putin, but these are the facts. That's the true complexion of these people. Is it somewhat like what happened in Tahrir Square where the liberals initially started the revolution, the Muslim Brotherhood, the more ideological people stayed out and then came in later and added weight and also firepower to some extent.
It is something like that. But then there's an element, kind of revolutionary fervor, the chaos, the enthusiasm and passions of the moment. There's no doubt that the foot soldiers of some of these groups were brave and defended the protesters and did good things as well. So part of that is, again, just the, as you say, you could compare it to some other revolutionary upheavals. However, they didn't stop there. And with their firepower, we could say, their armed paramilitaries and those who even threw firebombs at the Ukrainian police, they have exerted and continue to exert a kind of really undue pressure on Ukrainian authorities and those who chose the composition of the new government. They also, as we know, pushed hard to force the moderate Ukrainian leaders to back out of that earlier agreement that would have eased the transition of Yanukovych from office. There was a compromise agreement all sides had supported until these hardline far-right forces came in and said, no, Yanukovych has to go now. And arguably that led to a lot of unnecessary bloodshed. That same kind of pressure continues to be exerted. And I don't think that, as I said, the Ukrainian moderates who formed and now make up a good part of this new government feel that they can operate without constantly looking over their right shoulder, if you will, at the passions of the crowd. And that's how they got more portfolios than they deserve in the new government. And that's how they continue to pressure both the parliament and this temporary government in their kind of far-right nationalist direction.
Well, they were also, the Svoboda people in the new government were responsible for pushing for a parliamentary vote that downgraded the Russian language, and which, of course, was an unpopular edict from Yanukovych, but that was subsequently revoked or repealed, I guess. But that has had tremendous consequences because, again, people who defend Putin's actions keep citing that as an example, the Russian language issue.
I mean, Ukrainian moderates left to their own devices, if they weren't under this kind of undue pressure, some of it explicitly physical pressure, without that, they would never have been so foolish as to make one of their very first moves in office in this divided country with the Russian population so nervous. Nevertheless, their first move is to pass in a majority of the parliament what was perceived correctly as a very anti-Russian move, even if it was more symbolic than real, because there's no immediate threat to the status of the Russian language in Crimea. It showed the intentions of this government going forward, what might happen over the long run. And again, as you point out, it showed this undue influence of the far right. It was a red flag in front of a bull.
Well, as you point out in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Robert English, Ukraine's menace from within, since the Soviet Union's collapse, millions of ethnic Russians or Russian speakers have endured loss of citizenship in the Baltic republics and been driven out of Central Asian jobs and homes and have suffered particularly virulent discrimination in Georgia, which in many ways was a root cause for the 2008 war. What's happening now in Russia is polls indicate that Putin is riding higher than ever. He's about 70% approval. Uh-huh. You know, you can imagine what an American politician would, how they'd feel about that. It's almost unheard of. And the Russian people are whipped up with all this propaganda. They're feeling very macho. They're feeling decades of humiliation have suddenly been lifted from them. But there's a whole element to this which I'm sort of trying to figure out for myself, and I'd like to get your opinion on. I'm not sure how much this is driven by geopolitics and by Russia's military concerns about NATO expansion eastward, since that's not on the table, or how much this is, whole thing is being driven by the new Tsar, the absolute power in Russia, Vladimir Putin, who saw his puppet, if you will, Yanukovych, run out of town, and his kleptocratic and tacky wealth exposed to the world with these vast palaces. My understanding is that Putin has even more palaces and even more money stashed abroad, and that I'm wondering how personal this is, that, you know, Putin, let's face it, this whole maneuver has restored his political luster. He's changed the subject from any possibility of looking into his excessive power and excessive kleptocratic activities. So it's all working out for him at this point, up until the point where blood is shed and then the whole thing could blow up. So give me a sense of what you think. How much of it is geopolitical or how much of it is personal?
Wow, there was a lot included in what you just said. Let me try to pull out three strands to comment on. The first is, of course, it's geopolitical as well. It always is. Putin wants to and is expanding his influence, his hegemony, or at least his soft dominance of former Soviet republics. But he and many Russians see that as pushing back, not pushing forward, but pushing back against the expansion of American and the American-led NATO alliance's influence in his former backyard. And they do have a point. None of us, Americans, British, whatever we might be, could look kindly just serenely on adversary alliance continually adding new members and pushing up to our borders. And as you said, that Ukraine's membership in NATO is off the table, but for how long? Right? Russia doesn't see that as any kind of permanent guarantee. And NATO taking over their bases in Ukraine, NATO right into the heart of the traditional Russian and Slavic sphere of influence, just terrifies them. So yes, it's about geopolitics on both sides. But let me go back to what you began with in your last comment, and that is Russians' feeling of victimization. And this is something we overlook at our peril. And again, it's easy to overlook it because Putin has been so over the top with his propaganda and his threat mongering. Even though there are threats there, he's made them so ridiculous that nobody believes him. We have to understand that Russians have suffered an enormous amount, and the things that I pointed out that you cited are very often forgotten. Millions of Russians in the Baltic republics were immediately deprived of their citizenship upon the collapse of the Soviet Union. In many cases, they'd lived there for several generations but found themselves disenfranchised simply because of their ethnicity. And similar kinds of pressure, forced exodus on Russians in Central Asia. Then there's the Georgian example. Russians live with this on a daily basis. Many have relatives who've had to flee some of these regions, again, discriminated against solely for their ethnicity. They don't like being blamed for things that Stalin did, 40, 50 years ago. They find that this, you Russians did this, you did that. They can acknowledge the horrible treatment of Ukrainians by Stalin, or the illegal annexation of the Baltic republics. But they didn't do that, and yet they're the targets of the strong anti-Russian sentiment on the part of these smaller nations all around the former Soviet Union. So they've suffered economically, a lot of discrimination, things that are very often, almost always ignored in the West. And we tend to think, well, you're Russians, you're the imperialists, this was your empire. How can you be complaining now? How can you be playing the victim? The fact is, it was the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and especially its leadership under Joseph Stalin, that did all these horrible things, not ordinary Russians, who suffered as much as ordinary Ukrainians or ordinary Latvians and Estonians. They feel that for, 20 years, the world has forgotten that they were victims too, and instead is blaming them as an entire people for the sins of various czars or commissars.
So to the question of Putin's criminality, if you will, I mean, a lot of people think that he's basically a thug and a thief, and that this is personal, that he sees his puppet go under. I spoke yesterday with Angela Stent, who's been at the highest levels of U.S. government Russian policy for quite a long time. She was with Putin at the time of Gaddafi's fall, and she said, he was quite freaked out about what happened to Gaddafi. But
I think he was freaked out by what happened to Gaddafi, mainly because it was an example of, again, the NATO alliance.
Sure,
remember,
sure.
The resolutions that empowered the military action there were only supposed to be defending the opposition, mm-hmm. but they were quickly used as a tool for regime change. That's what scares him, not any personal affinity for Gaddafi or any personal like for other corrupt dictators. Sure, he's corrupt. So was Yanukovych. But guess what? Everyone's hero and hope for future Ukrainian president, Yulia Tymoshenko, right. was a corrupt oligarch as well.
Oh.
She has foreign bank accounts.
Sure.
She has palatial homes. when she was running the corporation that imported natural gas from Russia under a previous prime minister, she became fabulously wealthy. She was once known as the gas princess.
Right.
There are no absolute heroes and absolute villains here. And everybody in Russian politics and everyone in Ukrainian politics is significantly corrupt. I don't mean everyone in the country. There are brave opposition fighters. There are anti-corruption campaigners. But I mean people at high levels of power. We went through this once with the Orange Revolution, right? It's almost replaying. When back in 2004, 2005, an older, corrupt, pro-Russian Ukrainian government was swept out by people power. And the pro-Western liberals came in. And that was President Yushchenko and his prime minister, Yulia Tymoshenko. And they botched things up marvelously. That's the reason that the Ukrainians voted Yanukovych back in, because the liberals were just as corrupt and just as incompetent. So I don't see affinity for some other guy who has palatial homes or who skims off the top has anything to do with this. Top leaders in all these countries are absolutely practical and cynical about that.
And also, I think just in closing, in terms of the pot calling kettle black, ugly nationalism is just as alive and well in Russia as it is in Ukraine. I mean, the Cossacks who are whipping pro-Ukrainian protesters in Crimea, they're just as anti-Semitic as Svoboda, right?
Yeah, but they're not in power. And now Svoboda has, as I said,
that's
70
true.
Key positions in the new government, and that's what makes it different.
Well,
and bizarrely, as you say in closing, sometimes we have to step back and look at this whole spectrum of politics and realize we could do a lot worse than Putin. In other words, there are far-right forces. There are equivalents of the extreme, skinhead, violent, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic Russian nationalism that are just another variant of Svoboda in Ukraine. But they're not in power. And, Putin he does play on nationalism for his own domestic popularity, but at the same time, he keeps even worse forces out of power. It's a strange position. I don't like to be praising Putin, but we could do even worse. Russia has such deep problems and so many angry and dispossessed people who would be willing to back, again, just as odious a right-wing nationalist figure as some of those that we see in Ukraine right now.
Well, Robert English, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the United States Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security. He's currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the escalating street battles and demonstrations in Venezuela.
I have breathed all the sea. Your orphan prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide when the sun comes up. It will be on your side.
Sabana porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Smildy, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. His research focuses on social movements, human rights, and culture in Venezuela, and Professor Smildy has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He currently is working on a book called Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights Under Chavez, 2008 to 2012. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thank you for the invitation.
And David, we stayed in touch as things have begun to unravel in Venezuela, and there are a lot of street protests that have been continuing now for weeks, started by some students, apparently by student movements, and it's largely being portrayed as a struggle between the middle class and the poor. The poor support the government and the middle class. Much of what we hear, at least the mail I get criticizing my coverage, says that, oh, they're all the oligarchs on the pay of the CIA, which is, of course, what Maduro keeps saying at all. But when I see pictures of the protesters, they may be middle class, but they don't look particularly rich, at least in an American middle class context. So give me a picture, since you're there, of who's fighting who.
Okay, this is, I think, indeed, these are protests that are largely middle class that are fighting against a government that presents itself as representing the lower classes. There has not been a whole lot of participation from other social classes in these protests, which does not mean that there's not widespread dissatisfaction with the government. It just means that they're not participating in these protests. These protests are largely manned by students that are from the autonomous and from the private universities. In other words, public autonomous universities and private universities, which are sort of bastions of the opposition now for 10, 15 years. And they are protesting against the government, largely about issues, the classic issues of the sort of middle-class base of the opposition, issues that have to do with liberty, have to do with freedom of expression, have to do with freedom of protest, as well as economic freedoms. And so what really got these protests going is that it was protests that were repressed. No, these protests have been going now for more than a month, and they started relatively small, but the government has, the National Guard and police forces have really acted really strongly against them with violence and jailing students, and that ends up getting more students out into the street. And I think it's not just that they're not just protesting about the repression, but I think that is sort of a metaphor for their larger discontent with the government, which they see as getting increasingly authoritarian, ever less democratic, and also, you know, behind that are some social and economic problems. You know, there's scarcity, there's inflation. The economy is doing very poorly, and there's just a lot of insecurity. So I think a lot of these are young people who are thinking, you know, what country am I going to have in the future? And so I think it is wrong to see these students as oligarchs or the sons of the elites or, you know, the rich and the wealthy. These are people that in the United States would be middle class. They'd be average kids. No, here they are relatively elite in the sense that it's a poor country, and the majorities are poor. But these are normal, everyday sort of kids that are seeing, you know, that there's not going to be a country for them, at least in the terms that they want in the future, and that's what they're protesting about.
But it seems that the government is engaged through these collectives, through these groups that go around on motorcycles and shoot up middle-class neighborhoods, that they're riding a tiger, aren't they? When a government unleashes vigilantes, it could get really ugly. I mean, one of the people that was just shot yesterday was a guy that was painting his house. And these guys come by swarm by on motorcycles. And then there was, of course, a 24-year-old university student studying mechanical engineering. He was shot in the chest. And on the other side, there was an army major, I think, shot in under mysterious circumstances. So give me a sense of these roaming bands of colectivos.
Okay, these colectivos, this is a situation that's very worrying, but I think it's important to have some historical perspective on this and try to keep it, you know, in the correct frame. Many of these colectivos actually date from before the Chavez period, in the 1980s. These colectivos, at least some of the most well-known ones, developed in western Caracas and different parts of the country among they ended up being sort of leftist community groups that did a lot of community things, but they also frequently were armed, and they imagined themselves as sort of being urban guerrilla force. And they have, you know, during the Chavez period, they sort of conceive of themselves as the defenders of the revolution. That if,
you know, the Chavez government and the Chavez and now Maduro government can't defend itself. It's up to them, and many of them are armed. And so, indeed, this is a big problem, you know. And I think, without a doubt, some of these deaths in the protests have been at the hands of the colectivos. Now, there's a problem with this, and that is that, you know, I think this image of the colectivos gets blown way out of proportion, because I think it's an image that has a really high resonance for sort of middle-class fears of, you know, poor people coming down and, you know, engaging in violence against them. And I think internationally, it really fits very nicely into the whole sort of rogue state narrative about countries like Venezuela. And so I think it's really been keyed into by journalists and I think blown out of proportion. Now, basically, anytime there are gunshots that, you know, happen in a protest and they don't come from uniformed police officers, well, then it's the colectivos. Anytime now that, you know, there's a group of two or more poor people on motorbikes, it's colectivos. So just the other day, a week ago, there was violence, you know, here in Caracas, and you read the news reports and you talk about colectivos coming to this neighborhood, but if you look closely at who it was that died, it was a National Guardsman, and it was a moto taxi. It was a motorcycle taxi driver. No, it wasn't protesters that died. It was two people that were sort of either working for the government or government followers. And so, you know, it's a very worrying thing. And I think, you know, especially you look at the cases of Cuba, you look at the case of Iran, you look at how sort of these vigilante groups can be used to quell protests and really sort of be used as a para-state mechanism to keep protesters in line. I think it's a very, very important issue. In fact, the other day I wrote an op-ed in which I referred to them as warlords and said that the government has the power and needs to disarm these groups and needs to do something about it, because it's not, you know, having people that are not actually state agents in control of security is not something, it is in itself a violation of human rights. And so I think it's a very serious issue, but it's something that needs to be kept in proportion, you know, and especially in this case where we have, you know, a month of protests in which there's been 25 murders. And oftentimes this now people say, oh, the government has killed 25 people. And they say, oh, the colectivos have killed 25 people. And actually you look at it, you know, among those 25, 10 are opposition activists. You know, 4 are government supporters, 3 are National Guardsmen, and 7 people are citizens that haven't participated in the protests at all. And so, you know, there's violence on each side. As you mentioned when we started talking here yesterday, there were 2 people killed in Valencia, and there was 1 National Guardsman. No, there's violence. There's arms on both sides. Venezuela is a country that has a real problem with gun control. No, I think there's probably even a higher per capita circulation of guns in Venezuela than there is in the United States, and there's arms on both sides. And so they're mainly small arms, but it's an issue on both sides.
But given what you've just described, this incendiary situation with a highly polarized polity between, you know, roughly speaking, the middle class and the poor, and lots of arms floating around, it seems to me that the government is not being particularly helpful. Aren't they driving the polarization? Haven't they done that from the beginning? Essentially declared class warfare. That seems to be state policy. And much of the media is controlled by the Chavistas, isn't it? They used to
be.
Yeah,
I think, absolutely. Absolutely. The, you know, one of the policies of the government for the past 10 years, you know, Chavez learned this lesson very well, and I think Nicolas Maduro has learned it as well, is that class polarization is in their interest. You know, if they can polarize the population on class terms, well, then they win elections. They have, you know, 50 to 60% on their side, simply because most people in Venezuela are poor. And so, you know, the irony is that the opposition sort of gleefully welcomes this idea of class polarization, because they have this tendency, you know, in the past 15 years to always think that they are the majority. They're absolutely convinced that they are the majority. In fact, one of the hashtags that the opposition use is Somos Mayoría, we are the majority. and they always think that the government is illegitimate and steals elections. And so it's this situation that the government has really taken advantage of, because if they can polarize, well, they win. And I think that indeed is part of what's going on here. The government has, you know, basically taken what was a modest protest movement at the end of February and has created this enormous protest movement basically by its actions, by repressing these protests and jailing people. And, you know, that has really put fuel on the fire. And I think part of that is, you know, certainly there's some hardline people in the government, but others think that, you know, this is something, there's a lot of people that have this sort of revolutionary discourse in this government that think that it's through conflict that they gain more control over the state, and that they can further the revolution, and that they can defeat the oligarchs that are trying to roll back the revolution. And so they're really pushing that direction. And the example that they think of and refer to is, you know, the previous conflict 10 years ago, 2002, 2004, there was also a real period of polarization and conflict. And Chavez ended up coming out ahead on that. You know, by the end, he won a recall referendum, and he was really seriously strengthened because he had full control of the government and the oil company. And so I think there's people in the government that think that, you know, this is a good thing. It's going to help Maduro really gain control over the country. I think the situation actually is quite different, in the sense that one of the reasons that Chavez came out on top in 2004 and really strengthened his hold on the country was that oil prices went up, and with some of the economic policy changes that they undertook, there was a real period of economic growth, and so people were very happy, and they saw their opportunities increasing. I don't think that's going to happen in Venezuela in the next year or two. No, I think it's possible that it could, but, you know, looking at the government's economic policies, I think there's still more economic hardship to come. And so I don't really think that this polarization is going to help the government in the way it has before. I think, you know, once this protest cycle recedes, I think that, you know, the government is going to encounter some very serious popularity problems like it had last September or October.
Well, David Smalley, I thank you very much for joining us from Caracas, Venezuela.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia. Professor Smalley has researched Venezuela for the past 20 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He's currently working on a book called Venezuela's Transition to Socialism, Politics and Human Rights Under Chavez, 2008 to 2012. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the chaos in Libya as the country appears to be poised to fall apart. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Mansour El-Kahia, who is a Libyan-American author, columnist, activist, and professor of political science. Dr. El-Kahia is currently the chair of the Department of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mansour El-Kahia.
Thank you for having me.
And Libya, of course, has been in chaos since the downfall of Gaddafi, but things have come to a head recently with rebels in the east taking over a number of oil terminals, and the government had an ultimatum to a North Korean-flagged tanker that if it left the port with this illegal oil, if you will, it would be sunk. And apparently there was an attempt, and naval ships did try to intercept as it left the port. there was an exchange, well, not an exchange of fire, but they fired on the tanker. Apparently a fire was seen on board the tanker, and that the U.S. Navy intervened to stop what they thought would be a huge environmental catastrophe. Is that your understanding of the kind of drama that just took place yesterday?
What's new to me is the American intervention. We don't really know where the tanker is. We assume it's in Egypt right now. It's sailed toward Egypt, and I think ultimately it's an Egyptian. It's an attempt by some of those members of the Jadran group in the east in Libya to sell the oil. And I think they made arrangements through some Egyptian firms, Egyptian personalities. I think it's standing in Egypt right now. But past me is I did not hear about the American intervention, isn't it? We're told there was fire on the tanker, but was never confirmed to us.
Well, apparently the Egyptian Navy is supposedly going to intercept the ship when it gets into, may well be already in Egyptian waters. But the North Koreans have disowned the ship. They revoked the Morning Glory's registration. So, okay, what's going on here?
Well, I mean, I tell you something. This is, and it's quite honest, and I'm being very sincere with you, not facetious at all. But you know, this is part and parcel of the democratic process in societies that never experienced democracy. I mean, what you see in Libya is fragmentation that has been suppressed and compressed for many, many years, and it's beginning to emerge. You know, the problem in Libya is really very, very serious in the sense that. It's composed of a number of problems, not only one. On the east, in the eastern provinces, you have an ideological problem between the liberals and the conservatives, very much so like anywhere else. We have more tribes in the east than we have in the west, but there's no tribal problems in the east. It's really between the Islamists and the liberals. We don't want an Islamic rule. In the West, the problem is much more different, in a sense that the West has never really been unified as the East has. And what you see, you have also tribes over there, but you don't have the tribal fights per se. You have regional, Masrata region, which has many tribes fighting against Zintan region, which has many tribes fighting against the Bin Walid. Region has many tribes fighting against Washifana, fighting against the Amazigh. And so the conflict there is much more regional conflict, and each region trying to acquire in mass as much power as it can in this vacuum. And the truth is that the competition between them can be so violent, it can lead to annihilation. I mean, one region can, in fact, is capable of annihilating another region. And this is how bad it is in the West. And, you know, but that voice, you hear it much more within the parliament. The Congress today is made up, of course, of people from the East and people from the West. The people from the East, believe it or not, tend to be the Islamists and the liberals. And they're continuing the fight in the parliament. The West, the problem is different. In the West, you have the militias playing a very, very, very important role through their regions. So the Zintanis have a very powerful militia, which is represented in the parliament. And the parliament tries to keep that Zintanis militia going by giving it money. And so it's a multi-layered conflict. In all of this, Saronika, which is the East, is saying, hey, listen, this centralization of power in the West is hurting us. We have the poverty here, we have the oil here, we have the water here, and nobody's paying much attention to us. So this group of individuals, which is led by the former guards of the installations, the oil installations, said, well, okay, we'll go our own way. At least we will sell the oil, we will keep 50% of the revenues, and we will give the other 50% to the West and the South, which they saw as a fair formula. Of course, the central government in Tripoli is not willing to accept that. And they said, no, you are outside the law, and you have to be held accountable, responsible, and we have to arrest you. They can't do it because if a Western force comes into the East, it will be tantamount to declaration of war in the East. And these groups and the huge militia in the East has acquired kind of legitimacy because the East has been neglected for so much. And so the government is not willing to chance it to start a civil war. Today, they had no choice. Today, in fact, today, they on Wednesday, the head of the parliament gave an ultimatum to the groups in the east to open up the oil fields within 2 weeks and to relinquish the power. If they don't, the others will in fact mass against them and come to liberate the oil fields from them. Now, I'm not too sure that this is a very good formula, because ultimately you might have a civil war taking place in Libya.
So just to go back over what's happened in the last couple of days up to the point that you just mentioned, where the government, the central government, as much as it controls the country, has given the rebels in the east the oil terminals, what, 24 hours or whatever?
Two weeks.
But prior to this, of course, the ultimatum not to let the North Korean ship leave, and the escape of the North Korean ship was a humiliation for Libya's Prime Minister, Ali Zeidan. He was dismissed by Parliament and fled the country, apparently for Germany. Is that your understanding?
Yes. Now, here's the one more thing. You see, let me tell you, it was a poll taken. Believe it or not, polls are now being taken in Libya, which is really encouraging in a way. And over 50% of the respondents did not agree with removing him. Another 15% said that removing him in this way was not right. Okay? So he has lots of support. Now, he left the country, of course, but, you know, according to some sources which confided in me, in fact, he was told that the decision against him would be forthcoming, and 24 hours before the decision actually came. And so, I mean, he left, and we believe he's in Germany. I have not spoken to him, but I'm in the process of doing that, and I will get the better story behind all that. But, you know, they have to understand something very important over here, that the structure itself of the government really gave the prime minister very, very, very little power. The prime minister was really, even though it was his threatening was all bravado. He had no power to actually carry out the threat, because he had no control of the military. The control of the military is under the head of the parliament. And so when Zeidan told the head of the military about 3 or 4 weeks ago to go down to the south and confront some of the Gaddafi loyalists, the head of the military says, "I don't take orders from you." You know, I take orders from the head of the parliament. And so whatever Zeidan did really made little sense. The problem lies in the structure of government. And I think the way it was set up by those who did 2 years ago is take into account that we don't want a dictator to emerge again, and therefore we don't give the executive any power at all. Now they're leaving to regret it, because what's happening is that initially it might have been to avoid dictatorship, but now we have dictatorship of the council. And the council doesn't do things rapidly. And so, I mean, they spent 12 weeks discussing how to remove the prime minister, and they couldn't agree on removing the prime minister. And, you know, while they were discussing this, the affairs of states were at a standstill. Nothing was got done, and people are frustrated and angry. And now there's more animosity and the hatred and dislike for the parliament than there is for Zeidan.
And so what about his replacement, the defense minister, Abdullah Al-Thani?
Abdullah Al-Thani, supposedly he's going to be there for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And within these 2 weeks, they're going to choose to select a new prime minister. But let me tell you, I mean, this is my gut feeling, I might be wrong in this, but I don't think they'll agree on a replacement. That is the source of the problem with Zeidan. They could not agree on somebody to replace Zeidan. And therefore, this is why Zeidan stayed in power. Zeidan is not the most perfect of individuals. But, you know, but he's better than the crop that we have now there. And even more important than all of this, he's being blamed for things which really are way beyond his capability. The Koreans did this ship, for example. The ship, you know, he gave orders to attack the ship. The Air Force rejected the order. He gave orders to the military to attack the ship. The military rejected the order. He could not do anything. He doesn't have a military. Libya has maybe 7,000, 8,000 now soldiers in training in the United States, in Bulgaria, in Italy, in France, and so forth. So Libya does not really have a military to deal with right now. And so Zeidan can make as much threats as he wants, but he really has no power to do any of that.
So back to the divide. And first of all, just based upon what you've just told us, Dr. Mansour El-Khair, it seems unlikely that this 2 weeks ultimatum could be exercised by the supposedly they're going to send special forces in. But you're saying that the minute that the government in the West moves its forces into the East, you're likely to have a conflagration. My understanding is that the historic eastern region of Cyrenaica was neglected under Gaddafi. Give us an idea of who the two forces are, the liberals, as you said, and the Islamists. Of course, you know, all we hear about the East is this constant insanity from the Republicans, in particular Senator Lindsey Graham, about Benghazi, which they've tried to turn into a domestic political issue. And it sort of clouds the real picture. So give us the real picture of what's going on in the East.
Well, we have the counterparts to Mr. Lindsey Graham over there in the East as well too, and these are called Ansar al-Sharia, and they are the fundamentalist groups that emerge after the fall of Gaddafi. They acquired power very rapidly in a political vacuum and in a military vacuum, training lots of youngsters now to actually fight and fight the war of the establishment of a caliphate. And even more dangerous than all of this is that they've invited so many of these fighters and radicals from across the Islamic world. You have, I mean, but what is this, 4 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, they had a huge conference of all the Al-Qaeda and other radical forces in Libya. They have three training camps in the East right now, okay? Three training camps that are training future terrorists. Libya's borders are porous. There's nothing to stop them from coming in. Libya is exporting the largest number of surface-to-air missiles anywhere. And in fact, even the United Nations just came up with a report on this issue. And there is no force to stop them. So there's no military force to stop them. The only force stopping them are people. People don't like what these Islamists are doing. I mean, Libyans are not radical by very nature, and they find what these Islamists are doing, these radical Islamist groups are doing, as being insulting to their own faith. And I assure you, large number of Libyans, and particularly in Cyrenaica, hated the idea of killing the American ambassador. And in fact, they came out in the thousands to demonstrate against those acts. But today, every single day, one or two, three security people are being killed by these radical Islamists, these fundamentalists. And there's nothing that we can do about that. And this is one of the main reasons why the government has used precisely the same thing against Zaydan, to remove him, that the security in Cyrenaica is not being maintained and so forth.
So during this nonsense over the so-called Benghazi incident with Lindsey Graham, who's still beating the drum on it, it was revealed that the CIA did have a station there, and that was in fact the one that was attacked, where the Special Forces veterans were killed. They were apparently trying to corral surface-to-air missiles. That was their mission. Yes. Presumably, based upon what you just told us, if the Islamists have lots of surface-to-air missiles, they didn't complete the job, the CIA.
No, they haven't. In fact, you know, about 2 months ago, they caught a huge shipment of surface-to-air missiles that was in Algeria. It was on its way to Mali. And, you know, had the radical Malian fundamentalists received that shipment, they would have grounded the French Air Force. And right now, there's so many of those missiles from the Gaddafi days that are in play. The whole region has become very, very dangerous for any aircraft flying in the region.
So do you think that these missiles are being used in Syria?
I have no doubt they're being used in Syria, and in fact, even much, much more so. In Syria, there's a recruitment of kids, of 17, 18, 19-year-old kids. They're fighting in Syria by these Islamic groups. In Derna now, in eastern Libya particularly, has been taken over by this fundamentalist group that has basically establish a Taliban form of government in that city, and people are running out of it by droves, by hundreds. They're leaving the city because they can't tolerate that type of system, and there's nobody really to help Libya right now to deal with this conflict. The world is too busy, of course, with the new bipolar structure that we begin to see. a long time ago, I said Russia, the Soviet Union might have gone, but Russia is still here, and the conflict is going to continue indefinitely. And now we see it in the Ukraine. We saw it in Syria. And in fact, but particularly when you talk about Syria, in Syria itself, there's nothing we can do. There's absolutely nothing we can do. We're held hostage by a UN vote. You know, but Libya, there's a chance to do something in Libya to stem this type of violence, to stem this type of terrorism. And yet the United States government, Mr. Lindsey Graham and all his supporters over there, are doing nothing to prevent the reoccurrence of Benghazi.
So just in closing then, what about the Egyptians, which is now, you know, they're basically a new military government. They clearly have no sympathy with Islamists, given their treatment of the Muslim Brotherhood. Explain to us what you originally said earlier about who is getting this oil and the deal that was made between the rebels in the east of Libya and the Egyptians using this North Korean ship that the North Koreans have just disowned.
Well, you know, I know of the people who are advising the head of this militia group. And these advisors have very, very close contacts to Egypt. And I have no doubt that some Egyptian groups, at least some Egyptian maybe money is behind this whole affair. It's not a big shipment. It's $30 million or whatever it is, okay? And they got a cut rate price, you know. And so the Egyptians are in bad shape right now. They're in bad shape for energy. Even the military government is not on good grounds because they can't destroy half of the population. I mean, 40% of Egyptians tend to believe in the Muslim Brotherhood. You can't say they declare that they're outlaws, you know. And you're right. It's become a new military government that it was under Nasser or Sadat or Mubarak or any of those. But there's an opportunity for capital, and then capital was able to make use of that shipment, and to give some money to the rebel militia in Salonika.
But again, Sisi's government would not be sympathetic to the Islamists. So, the militia that controls the oil in the east, how do you characterize that?
It's a secular militia. It's not an Islamic militia.
I see.
You don't want to destroy secular militias. You want to destroy Islamic militias.
Exactly. Well, we have a record of doing the opposite. We toppled Saddam Hussein, who was a secularist.
That's
and,
right.
And you end up with a religious Shiite government.
Exactly. I mean, it's really funny. I gave a speech about the last week in Benghazi, and I said I left Libya, and it was a secular state. It was a state in the 20th century. I've come back to Libya, and now I find that the country is in the 4th century. Something's wrong somewhere on the line, you know? And they all laughed. They said, yes, indeed, you're very right about that. I said, well, if I'm right, why don't you do something about it?
Well, we'll leave you on that question, Dr. Mansour El-Kaki. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mansour El-Kahir, who is a Libyan-American author, columnist, activist, and professor of political science. Dr. El-Kahir is currently the chair of the Department of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.